James Hamilton Bedgood and Robert Sorensen against Edwin Madeline and others. Council, please come to the council table. Please come to the table. The argument from petition.
May it please the court, Mr. Van Houston and Mr. Lefhine have been arguing for petition.
May please the court, I am Van Houston and along with Mr. Lev Hunt, represent the petitioners here and the defendants in the court below. Generally, by way of introduction, I'm going to explain to the court what we intend to do in our opening statements for the purpose of argumentation. Essentially, I'm going to outline the case as it comes to this court. I'm then going to review very briefly the points of error generally we're discussing here today, and then try to inform the court as to how we're dividing our argument in this first portion of the argument. Excuse me. The case involves an accident which occurred in September of 1974 in Corpus Christi, in which it's alleged a vehicle jumped a median and hit a small child. A suit was brought under the wrongful death statute and the survival statute by the parents of the child, Dr. and Mrs. Madeline, who is the plaintiffs here today. The suit was denominated one brought under the wrongful death and survival statutes, and on that condition, the defendant admitted liability. Upon trial of the case, the theory of the case, in our position, we feel was changed, in that there was an award made not only for the damages which customarily are awarded in wrongful death and survival actions, but also for damages to the parents individually for mental anguish and for loss of earnings in regard to Dr. Madeline.
Matter of interest, has this case been tried before?
No, Your Honor.
This wonder why it took so long to get here.
Well, there was a lot of wheeling and dealing before it ever came to trial, Your Honor, and I guess the wheels of justice in this case ran a little slowly.
54 to 80 is pretty good while.
That's right, Your Honor. It has, but it has not been tried before or appealed before. The points of error, by way of summary, generally were complaints of ours as to whether or not Dr. and Mrs. Madeline, in particular Dr. Madeline, can recover for any individual losses other than those under the statutory wrongful death and survival statutes, and as to whether or not there is foreseeability as a matter of law with regard to these injuries, whether or not the admission of liability extends to these extra matters, whether or not their pleadings support it, and finally, whether or not Dr. Madeline's testimony regarding potential contributions was appropriate and admissible testimony. The division of our argument is essentially going to be twofold. Mr. Hunt intends to argue for us what we consider to be the most extremely significant portion of this case, and that is the question of whether or not a bystander outside the zone of danger can recover damages for mental anguish because he perceives an injury to another. This, we feel, to be an extremely significant question, one with very far-reaching consequences. Mr. Hunt is going to devote his entire opening speech to that point. I'm going to discuss four other points, including the court's charge, the sufficiency of the evidence, the sufficiency of the pleadings when taken in light of the admission of liability, and finally, the tainting of the entire case by the admission of very highly prejudicial testimony regarding the mental anguish of the plaintiff's father. Generally, it can be broken down. Mr. Hunt is going to talk about what the court did, and I essentially am going to talk about how the court did it. Beginning with the court's charge, we are complaining in this court about the nature of the issues. In one portion of the charge, in issue number one, the court uses the pattern jury charge language, and what we contend is the general law of this type of case, and instructs the jury not to consider grief, mental anguish, and sorrow of the parents. The court turns around succeeding issues and proceeds to ask about those exact elements as matters of damages, seeking a monetary amount for them. The inherent contradiction between what is generally submitted in a wrongful death case and what was submitted in this case is apparent from the charge itself. On one hand, they tell the jury not to consider that type of matter, and then they turn around in charge and ask the jury to assign a dollar value for it. The pleadings in this case were couched expressly in the terms of the statutory causes of action for wrongful death and survival. There was never any pleading regarding any mental anguish of the parents, any lost earnings of the parents, or anything else. Following the plaintiff's reliance upon his petition, which remained unamended through the trial court, an admission of liability was made. And much to our surprise, in the trial court, come day of trial, it was held by the trial court that this admission of liability extended to mental anguish of parents, as well as loss of earnings for Dr. Madeline, which is something which perusal of the record will show was clearly not intended. And in fact, in the admission of liability itself, it talked about limiting the evidence to the sorts of matters which would ordinarily be admissible in a wrongful death case. The court held otherwise, and by doing so, exposed the defendants to a type of liability which they had not admitted to. The sufficiency of the evidence in this case is another point on which we complain. And that is that the type of evidence which Dr. Madeline testified to in regard to his pecuniary loss amounted in our position to pure speculation. The trial court, we believe, considered this and recognized this in receiving the evidence. Dr. Huber, who was a doctor who had a son who referred him cases, started to testify about the exact point which Dr. Madeline eventually did testify. The trial court held he could not do so. Dr. Madeline took the stand, having never been a party to a relationship, having no personal knowledge, admittedly, of what type of referral a father-son relationship would entail, and proceeded to make a string of assumptions which I believe to have been purely speculative. For example, he was assuming that an 11-year-old boy would go through junior high, high school, college, medical school, intending full while to be a doctor, pass all the requisite boards, be licensed, stay in Corpus Christi, be of a different type of practice from his father, so there would be a possible referral basis. And then further assume that 20 years in the future or whenever, that Dr. Madeline would not have a sufficient practice and would require this type of help. And Dr. Madeline would have to assume all of this under the evidence in order to be able to testify as to what the pecuniary advantages of having a son in practice would be, possibly 20 years in the future. We submit that this is pure, the purest kind of speculation, and harks back to the case decided by the court a few weeks ago, Moore versus Grantham, which although we do not contend is controlling, does address this type of situation in which a person testifies about a loss having really no personal knowledge about it at all. The Court of Civil Appeals in this case cited the decision of State versus Evans, which was a condemnation case. And in that case, relied on by the Court of Civil Appeals below, the court expressly limited the type of testimony used in that case to condemnation cases, or, as the court said, the cases of this sort. And it's our position that the testimony of Dr. Madeline amounted to nothing more than speculation and should not have been admissible. He had testified that he had lost perhaps 50% of his practice as a result of the boy's death. In the first year, going down to 30, 20, and 10% in successive years. And he testified that he would have been perhaps able to obtain $20,000 to $30,000 in the future were his son available to refer him cases. This is one of our points which we believe, even if the law were other than we believe it to be, to be far too speculative to support the damage award in this case. We believe, in summary, as our last point indicates, that the nature of the evidence in this case painted in the case. There is intermingling of evidence and issues between things properly considered in a wrongful death case and things which actually were considered. Testimony, for example, from the doctor about how he would cry when passing the spots where he and his son had been during their lives, talking about not being able to sleep at night. Things such as this, which the review of the record will show, could hardly fail to inflame the jury and result in the type of award which was awarded. And there's simply no way which defendants, at least we can conceive at this time, could do other to show that we were influenced or were harmed by this type of evidence being admitted over objection.
Was the same special, the same wording and the special issue for the mental suffering of the mother as for that of the father? I know the mother is present throughout the case, but I'm wondering, were the special issues worded the same as to them with respect to the mental suffering?
It was substantially the same, Your Honor.
Were there any differences other than the names of the people?
Your Honor, the difference arose in that there was a question as to the loss of earning capacity of the father, and there wasn't any such issue submitted as to the mother. But the question simply, would you find the amount reasonably compensate father or mother for the mental anguish, if any, sustained by her as a result of the death of Robert Maddow? This is the same in both issues. Your Honor, at this time, I'm going to pass the case to Mr. Hunt for discussion of what we believe to be a highly significant issue.
May it please the Court, I'm Lyle Hunt from Corpus Christi, and I also represent the petitioners, M.S. Cause Law and Mr. Kuzman. Judge Greenhill, the answer to your question as to why this has taken so long is partially because there were two sets of attorneys representing the plaintiffs in this case, partially because there were extensive settlement negotiations, and partially because of the docket of the Corpus Christi Court. But
it's just shocking to me that a case would take that long.
Well, once it was set, Your Honor, it went fairly fast. Now, I want to just briefly give the Court factual background with respect to this. This case involves, as Mr. Kuzman told you, the death of Robert Madeline, 11-year-old son of Dr. and Mrs. Herbert Madeline of Corpus Christi. Robert was in his front yard playing when he was struck by a vehicle driven by one of the petitioners. Dr. Madeline was in the backyard of his residence, working near his swimming pool, and Mrs. Madeline was in a shopping center located about a half a mile to a mile away. Dr. Madeline testified that he heard the screech of brakes, heard a scream, went through his house and found his son there on the curb, bleeding from extensive injuries. The petition, insofar as damages are claimed, is this, and I quote, "Plaintiffs bring this action pursuant to and under the Texas Wrongful Death Act, Article 4677, Burns, Texas Civil Statutes, and the Texas Survival Statute, Article 5525, Burns, Texas Civil Statutes." And that was it. No mention made of any mental anguish to Dr. Madeline, of any mental anguish to Mrs. Madeline. No mention of any loss of earnings on the part of Dr. Madeline. No mention of a number of the elements and the issues that the court submitted. Now, Judge Garwood, the issues with respect to Mrs. Madeline was identical as to Dr. Madeline, except that, of course, the name was changed. The answers were different. $25,000 was awarded to Mrs. Madeline, $20,000 to Dr. Madeline for mental anguish. But I guess that the jury made up for that by awarding Dr. Madeline another $5,000 in loss of earning capacity. So that under the jury verdict, they both got, or they each got $25,000. The Court of Federal Appeals modified by eliminating the recovery by Mrs. Madeline on the basis that she was at a shopping center a half mile to a mile away, that any mental anguish she might have recovered was by virtue of learning as opposed to perceiving. But they affirmed Dr. Madeline's recovery of $25,000 for mental anguish, mainly, I think, on the basis of the case of Landreth versus Reed out of the Texarkana Court of Civil Appeals, which was a case where a sister saw an infant daughter taken out of a swimming pool, and the Texarkana Court of Civil Appeals allowed recovery for mental anguish. In that case, there was no writ read or no writ applied for in that case. No writ applied for, but that was the case, I believe, on which the Corpus Christi Court of Civil Appeals relied in affirming the recovery by Dr. Madeline. Now, our position with respect to this is that the legal principles that govern this case are clear, Your Honors. Starting in 1890 with King versus Hill, in 1900 with GC&SF versus Haley, in 1939 in Carey versus Pure Distributing Company, which is identical factually to what we have here. In Carey, that was a case where Mr. Carey was on a cot, laying on a cot outside of a mobile home next to a highway. Mrs. Carey was inside the mobile home. A top of an oil can came off, a truck that was proceeding along the highway, bounced along and hit Mr. Carey in the head. And Mrs. Carey heard the noise, heard the commotion, came out, saw blood all over Mr. Carey. And Mrs. Carey had a miscarriage. She was about, I believe, 3 months pregnant. Now there, this court, in 1939, this court held as a matter of law that Mrs. Carey could not recover mental anguish, and the court specified the reason. The court said that any recovery, as far as she was concerned, was too remote, that it was not, in fact, foreseeable, that the defendant in that case could not foresee, as a matter of law, that Mrs. Carey was going to have the injury of a miscarriage. And there the jury, Your Honors, found as a matter of fact that the negligence of the defendant had proximately caused the injuries to Mrs. Carey, so that the jury, there was a jury fact-finding there of proximate cause. This court held as a matter of law there could be no recovery. The court says at page 850, the injury to Mrs. Carey resulted alone from fright in the manner and way and under the circumstances above detailed. As to her, we think her injuries were too remote from defendant's negligence to meet the above announced rules of law. In other words, we think it can hardly be said that the owner and the driver of this truck ought to have foreseen injuries such as Mrs. Carey received. So this court in 1939 is saying foreseeability is the answer. Foreseeability is the answer. Judgment is denied for the injuries received by Mrs. Carey. 30 years later, 1967, Kaufman versus Miller. This court had occasion to look at the recovery or a request for recovery of mental anguish again. The court recalls that there was a case where a tractor trailer was driving along a freeway. The defendant's car entered the freeway on a 45-degree angle, just barely struck the right rear tire of the trailer. The driver of the tractor trailer had been in a serious accident some 3 or 4 years ago in which 2 or 3 people had been killed. He had some sort of neurosis as a result of that prior accident. And when he learned of this very slight accident that occurred on the freeway, he had a very serious disabling mental condition developed. And there, this court says, it is clear that the collision caused serious and disabling nervous disorders. In other words, the cause and fact element of proximate cause is present here, and we, the Supreme Court of Texas, find that it's present. But they go ahead to say, quote, the serious question is whether we should hold as a matter of law that the defendant could not reasonably have foreseen that the injuries to the plaintiff's nervous system would be a natural and probable consequence of her negligent conduct. We so hold. Close quote. There, the court is holding as a matter of law that there cannot be recovery for mental anguish in that situation. And this is what the court also says in that case. Quote, courts have been virtually unanimous in recognizing that one who suffers injury from mental shock as a result of an injury or threatened injury to a third person cannot recover damages from the negligent tortfeasor. The court cites Prosser for that proposition and the reason for it. Prosser says that the reason that usually assigned for denying recovery for emotional shock because of fear of injury to a third person is that the defendant could not reasonably anticipate any harm to the plaintiff and therefore owes her no duty of care. And then this court quotes from Prosser, and it says, quote, it would be an entirely unreasonable burden on all human activity if the defendant who has endangered one man were to be compelled to pay for the lacerated feelings of every other person disturbed by reason of it, including every bystander shocked at an accident and every distant relative of the person injured, as well as his friends. And obviously the danger of fictitious claims and the necessity of some guarantee of genuineness are even greater here than before. It is no doubt such considerations that have made the law extremely cautious. There have been some Court of Civil Appeals cases recently that sort of give the impression that Carey and Kaufman are no longer the law. The earlier cases that I mentioned, King versus Hill and GP&SF versus Haley, have allowed some recovery, and some of the Court of Civil Appeals cases go off on those aspects. For instance, Snelling versus Lincoln Mercury out of Houston. Mother and a baby in a, riding in the back seat of a car. The door is defective. The door comes open. The baby falls out on the freeway, is run over and killed. The mother sees that. Recovery allowed there, NRE, by this court. Reason, the mother, I submit, was in the zone of danger. And I think the Court of Civil Appeals recognizes that. The mother was in the zone of danger just as much as the baby who fell out of the back seat, because the mother was sitting next to the defective door, too. Recovery allowed there. Covington versus the state of Foster, Waco Court of Civil Appeals. Situation where parents were in the car with their child. The defendant came over on the wrong side of the road. There was head-on collision. Recovery was allowed to the parents there because they were clearly in the zone of danger. They were hurt in that same accident. The case didn't involve their injuries because their part of the case had been settled. And only the part of it seeking recovery for mental anguish due to the injuries received by the child was an issue there. The third Court of Civil Appeals case along this line is that of Landreth versus Reed, on which the Corpus Christi Court of Civil Appeals based its opinion, as I said. Landreth is, in my judgment, an aberration. It does not follow any of these cases. It does not follow Snelling. It does not follow Covington. The sister there was on the bank of the swimming pool. She was in no danger herself. But nevertheless, the Court of Civil Appeals, the Texas County Court, permitted recovery for mental anguish in that situation. We believe, Your Honors, that the rule now with respect to attempted recovery for mental anguish for injury to another one, to another person, a relative or otherwise, is that those cases are to be determined by the traditional concepts of negligence and proximate cause and foreseeability that have always been with us. That there is nothing new in connection with that. That there are two elements of proximate cause. First, cause in fact, and second, foreseeability. That as to the second element, foreseeability, this court has held on numerous occasions, and other courts have held, that the limits of foreseeability are the zone of danger.
What is the zone of danger?
The zone of danger is where the individual who suffers, who purportedly suffers the mental anguish, is in danger himself of being injured.
How do you square that with Hill against Kimball? Are you familiar with that case?
I'm not as familiar as
well,
I should be.
Well, it's an early
You started with it.
I started with it, I know that. But that's an 1890 case, Joe.
Well, it was...
I mean, your argument began.
Yes, I know.
This was a case in which the bystander saw an assault by the landlord upon two people, and there was a fight.
Yes.
And the plaintiff suffered a miscarriage for which she was permitted recovery. She was a bystander.
Yes, sir. I can square that only on the zone of danger concept, Your Honor.
Just the closeness, the nearness of the closeness.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Now, there is one other, Houston Electric Company versus Darcet, I believe, where a mother was walking across the street with a child. The mother was injured, the child was not. That's a zone of danger case, in my judgment. But I think what the courts are saying is that zone of danger is as far as we're going to allow mental anguish to go. And that if the individual claiming mental anguish is not in the zone of danger, there is not going to be any recovery.
Is a parent in a zone of danger behind a fence that would protect him from any danger, but yet witnessing what happened to his child?
That, Your Honor, is going to be one of the questions that I'm going to be arguing on closing as to why the court ought not to change the rule. You're going to run into shades and variations just like that. Questions of how near is closely related. What are we talking about? Are we just talking about parents and children, or are we talking about nephews and nieces and uncles and aunts? Are we talking about good friends? Are we talking about local parentis people? Are we talking about others who are shocked just as much as anyone else by the death of a close friend? That's the type of thing, Your Honor, that the court can worry about for months, I believe, and not come up with an answer.
Well, you would say that the bystander must himself be in danger.
I think the cases say that, Your Honor. I honestly think the cases say that. Now, applying that rule to this case, Dr. Madden was back of a five-bedroom home. He was 125 feet away. There is no way that he was within the zone of danger. So we say that applying the rules that have been the law for 100 years, for almost 100 years,
Since Powell's grant.
All right. Well, I don't know what year Powell's graph was.
28.
All right, let me cut that in two. 50 years. Applying the law to this case, Your Honor, it seems to me that as a matter of law, that Dr. Madlin, outside the zone of danger, cannot recover.
May I ask you a question, please?
Yes, Your Honor.
In course time, attorney who preceded you talked about your settlement, or not a settlement, but agreement as to liability.
Yes, sir.
At that time, had the case been pleaded?
The case was just, the case went to trial on plaintiff's original petition.
At the time you made your agreement that you would not contest liability, what was the status of the plaintiff's pleading?
It was that. The original petition was the only petition that had been filed, and what I read to the court in quotations.
At the time, then, you agreed that your client would be liable, and then the question is how much.
Yes.
What was the status of the pleadings, and you may have already stated it, with regard to mental anguish and loss of earnings?
There were none. There were no pleadings whatsoever with respect to those aspects. The only thing in issue was the wrongful death statute and the survival statute.
The argument from the respondent.
May I please report? Mr. Russell McMaine will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. I'm Russell McMaine. Counsel on this appeal, at the request of Mr. Allison, appear in his stead, for Dr. Herbert Madeline and his wife Sally, who attempt to sustain the recovery that was awarded to Dr. Madeline for a total of $25,000 as a result of the mental anguish and depression, physical manifestations thereof, that he suffered as a result of the death of his 11-year-old son. He was in the backyard at the time, admittedly approximately 120 to 125 feet away. He did hear the scream contemporaneous with it and testified that he recognized the voice of the minor as being his own child, that it was his son. He knew it at that time, and he went to the front yard immediately in total anguish, and there is ample evidence in this record as to what has transpired subsequent thereto, and the justifiably explained depression as a result of it. There is no issue in my judgment here of foreseeability, and I'd like to explain and amplify on that. First, and I think most significantly, only last week this court made an observation in the passage of its opinion, and the opinion offered by Justice Campbell, and says it much better than I can say it in regards to the protection of the interest that we're talking about in this case. The court has frequently emphasized, in quoting from the Supreme Court opinion in Stanley versus Illinois, the importance of the family. The rights to conceive and to raise one's children have been deemed essential, basic civil rights of man, and rights far more precious than property rights. Same thing.
Suppose this were a nephew.
Your Honor, with regards to the attempt to delimit who may recover for the mental anguish because of the interference tortiously with the family relationship, I submit to you that the wrongful death statute itself offers some evidence as to the type of beneficiaries that are within the parameters of it.
Let me back you off just a little. I think, suppose the husband, Harry perceived this, called his wife, the mother, in New York City and said, our son has just been killed. And she screamed and fainted and had a miscarriage. Now, are you concerned at all about the zone of danger?
Your Honor, first of all, I am not concerned about the zone of danger. Let me suggest to the court that I think that the zone of danger has never been really forthrightly embraced by this court.
It's in Houston Electric against Selma Dorsey.
What I'm suggesting is that in reality, the test that is articulated by the court in its most recent pronouncement in Kaufman versus Miller is more of a concept of weighing factors in foreseeability generally, and that zone of danger and foreseeability are not necessarily the same thing. That the issue of foreseeability is not just danger of harm to that individual. As a prime example, the wrongful death statute gives a right of recovery in their representative and beneficiary capacities to individuals who are damaged economically, as well as in other ways.
I guess I owe you an apology. I had understood you did not consider that recovery for the wife was permissible.
Well, to be perfectly honest with you, Your Honor, I think an argument can be made, and I think the argument probably should have been made, that it is permissible. I think the argument in the Court of Civil Appeals that was made, and that there was basically a concession, that the wife does not fit the factors in Landreth versus Reed.
Because she was not in the zone of danger.
Well, not because she was not in the zone of danger, Your Honor, but because she did not have an experiential perception, which is the factor that is used in Landreth versus Reed, which is adopted from Dillon versus Legge, which is the California Supreme Court limitation.
Before asking about the special issues, do you submit your damages for experiential? Are your damages limited to those that arise from experiential perception, or do your damages include the grief, which I think is certainly foreseeable if any relative is going to have at the death of another relative, whether or not they have an experiential perception of it?
It's a difficult task to try and draw a line about what mental anguish is. where it ends and where it begins. We've attempted to do so in wrongful death recoveries for years by saying you don't consider mental anguish, you don't consider grief, sorrow, solace, sympathy. That's consistent with the argument that you're not supposed to be biased or prejudiced, and that that's not the function of the jury, but rather to assess damages for something that you can determine has a pecuniary value. What I'm suggesting is that the court, in 1978, in Whittlesey versus Miller, specifically recognized there is a cause of action that arises from one spouse to the injury to the other spouse because of the injury to the relation. Because it is an injury to the relation. Not on the basis of any foreseeability, and not on the basis of any geographical proximity or zone of danger.
I don't think you had opportunity to respond to my question a moment ago. Are you saying that this should be, well, it wasn't your fault, another question were asked. Are you suggesting that this is limited to the immediate family?
I am suggesting that I won't really presume to tell the court what the limitations of it are, except my argument is based on, yes, the immediate family is what really is embraced within the concept of the invasion of a right to family.
So that's why you eliminate foreseeability, based on the family relation.
It's not a question of eliminating it, Your Honor. What I am suggesting is that as this court has held, and as the statutes in the state of Texas on wrongful death recoveries have provided since their inception, when you kill or maim my wife or kids, you injure me. Is it foreseeable that people that you injure, maim, or kill, if the issue is foreseeability, is it foreseeable that you will damage the other persons in the immediate family, that they will suffer loss for which compensation will lie? I submit to you the issue factually is not one of foreseeability.
No.
It may be a disguised foreseeability question. It's really an issue of the scope of duty. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt the court.
My mother is still alive. If I should be killed in an automobile accident, would you think my mother would be entitled to recover from mental anguish?
In the event that the damage recovery in terms of whether or not there is required
she's
connection...
She's as much my mother as these people
I agree.
Here.
I agree. And my
she's 91 years old, but...
Yes, I understand. And I believe that she can. I believe she's been damaged. I believe the family relations have been damaged. Now, I think the damages with regards to a minor obviously may be more.
No, but you're like applying a rule of consortium, is that what you're in effect?
I'm basically arguing by analogy to what the court said specifically in dealing with the loss of consortium as an independent cause of action by one spouse on behalf of the other. I am suggesting here that in reality the foreseeability issue is basically an issue that I personally believe is misperceived by the courts as a limitation. I think that it is foreseeable, as a matter of fact, and that any court really, sitting as a jury or as a court, would say it is foreseeable that when you damage someone through your negligence, whether you're assault or whatever, that you injure the other people and impact the other people that are immediately associated and connected with these people and have every reason in the world to have that relationship protected.
Is that foreseeable as a matter of fact or a matter of law?
Well, both. I think that in truth, that the question is the family relationship itself something which is subject to legal protection? This court last week held, yes, it borders on being a fundamental right. It has recognition in the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, the Ninth Amendment, I submit in the 14th Amendment.
Now, well, there are constitutional rights and condemnation. In every kind of a case you can think of, there are constitutional rights. Now, does that make any difference?
Your Honor, what I'm suggesting here is that, and pardon me if I'm misleading the court or leading them astray off of what
we remember
court
case.
Wants to concern. I'm sure the court does, and I'm sure it was hotly contested at the time. Whittlesey, however, is a unanimous opinion and says that an injury to the relationship is an injury to the other spouse. Geographical proximity is not an issue. Foreseeability is not an issue in that case. Now, I submit that damage to the family unit, in terms of the immediate family unit, and whatever circumscription you wish to put on it, the very narrowest that you could justifiably put on it in this case is a protection to the immediate family unit in terms of people who live together as a family unit.
So you're not particularly suggesting what you might call a California rule or the perception rule, but you would say the family rule, however then would the
Your Honor, that's an alternative argument. And I am going to argue that the California rule states legitimate factors, and that if this court is concerned about foreseeability and attempting to restrict the protection of the interest of the family, and what I perceive to be family.
That would apply even if your wife was killed in an automobile accident in Chicago.
That is correct, Your Honor, just as it would apply in terms of loss of consortium, I believe, under the Whittlesey versus Miller opinion. I believe that there is a damage to the relation.
Well, counsel, this argument interests me. You are drawing a distinction then between loss of the child and which is one damage, kind of a damage, and mental anguish, on the other hand.
Yes, Your Honor.
Did your pleading speak mental anguish, or this thing you're talking about?
Your Honor, our pleadings...
I came up here on the bench thinking that this was a case of how far do you leap to extend mental anguish.
That's what I'm talking about, is mental anguish as the aspect of which a recovery for loss of a child. I submit that that is endemic to the pleading for wrongful death of the minor. Now, of course, the question of the scope of the pleading, and needless to say, I did not participate in the drafting of the pleadings, but the question of the scope of the pleadings, I think, first of all, is decided within the parameters of what this court recently recognized in the Sevenless versus Harville decision. I believe they're on notice. There is no question that they have notice as to what the damages are that are claimed in this case. In point of fact, there is much discussion on this record in the early part of the statement of facts that they knew precisely what was involved.
Now, are you going to get on that? Because I want to talk to you about that when you get there.
Your Honor, I'll be glad to talk about it now. The court's convenience.
I had understood counsel to agree that their client would be liable, and the question would be how much, at a time when the pleadings did not include these elements as part of the cause of action.
Your Honor, the pleadings per se have never really been amended as such.
Well,
on either in terms to include elements that were not in the first one. If they weren't there in the first one, then they weren't there after all.
Well, we should have been impaired constitutional rights and all that sort of thing. And a counsel agrees and he persuades his client to say, look, we ought to admit liability and just have the jury say how much. And then the other side drags in, or is let in, other elements that were not before the lawyers when they told their client, this is why we ought to give up and just say how much. That seems a little bit basically unfair to me.
Your Honor, let me, if I may address that in this respect. Number one, Second Amendment answer filed contemporaneous with the stipulation of liability. The admission of liability, which they tendered, which incidentally is not a, I frankly am not party to the particular negotiations as to how it was done, but it is a unilaterally filed instrument on behalf of the defendant. It accompanies a second amended answer where there is a specific attempt to circumscribe the elements of damages on a defensive basis. I believe that a fair reading of the second amended answer is the anticipation that the mental anguish claim is in fact embraced in the original petition. It says that you are limited to only pecuniary losses, etc., and not to anything else, not to sorrow, grief, mental anguish, etc. There are specific defensive pleadings on that in the second answer filed contemporaneous with this document. Secondly, prior to trial, in the pre-trial conference, there was discussion about this. The Snelling case is specifically presented and discussed to opposing counsel at that time. That discussion is in the record. Or the discussion about that discussion at the pretrial conference is in the record. Third, the judge at that time issues his statement that I believe the pleadings are broad enough to cover it, and I believe that your stipulation is broad enough to cover the recovery for it and the liability for it. There is absolutely nothing done thereafter. There is, in essence, a resignation by Mr. Hunt in trial to the effect of, well, so be it. There is no attempt to withdraw the admission of liability, which has already been construed by the judge, and this is prior to the trial commencing. There is no attempt in any way to move for a continuance or to plead surprise and withdraw the announcement of ready or to take any other kind of action that would be consistent with a claim that we are amazed that this is not going to be litigated.
Let me one point. Am I mistaken in assuming that the recovery under the wrongful death statute does not include mental anguish?
Your Honor, my first argument, and perhaps I did not characterize it adequately, the first thing I was attempting to argue is that as an element of compensatory loss, that under 4677, the mental anguish to the survivors and the immediate family ought to be a recoverable element. Now, that's the first argument.
Whether pleaded or not.
And, well, there were wrongful death statute recoveries that were sought. There are pleadings that say that they're asking for their damages in the total sum of $200,000, so they're general. There's no special exception to that or as to the itemization of damages as to how it's to be characterized. As I indicated, there have been discussions throughout the proceedings. There is the second amended answer on file that I believe reflects that they were aware of the posture of the case and the claim. The issue is tried expressly by consent. There's no attempt by anybody whatsoever at the trial level to withdraw that unilateral.
City is entitled to grandfather rights under the Public Utility Regulatory Act for water service officers 1955. Section 53 of the Public Utility Regulatory Act, and I'll probably refer to it as PURA just for brevity, creates a grandfather mechanism whereby any public utility that was providing service on the effective date of the act could come in, make application, and get certified for that pre-existing service. The City of Tahoma filed its application timely. The requisite filing date is March 1st, 1976. The Act gave you 6 months and the effective date to get your application in. And you had to have been serving areas on the effective date of the Act, which was September 1st, 1975. Tahoma filed its application on time, and sometime later, Howard County Water Control and Improvement District filed an application for water service, but not under Section 53, the grandfather section. It filed under Section 54, the merit certificate section of the Act. I'd like to just tell you a little bit about the service area that we're talking about here. It's in Howard County, which is out in West Texas, out near Big Spring. The City of Tahoma has been serving an area that includes the city limits of Tahoma and the area bounded by the Water Control and Improvement District, Howard County Water Control and Improvement District number 1, and also some connections outside the boundaries of the district. So you're talking about a fairly large service area. This service, as I mentioned, has been provided since 1955. A hearing was held by the Commission on a consolidation of consideration of both applications, the city's grandfather certificate request and the district's merit certificate request. At the hearing, the City of Tahoma introduced uncontroverted evidence of its filing on time and introduced abundant evidence about its service for this continuing period. And the only conclusion warranted by the evidence is the city, in fact, met the two criteria set out in Section 53. There was absolutely no evidence introduced at the hearing which would warrant a conclusion that the city's service area within the city limits was in any way different from or severable from the service area outside the city limits. And yet, the Commission found in its order, without stating any reasons for this finding, that Tahoma was only entitled to certification within the city limits. And they granted the service area outside the city limits to the Water Control and Improvement District that had this merit certificate application pending. The district court properly found that this action was arbitrary and said that Tahoma was entitled as a matter of law to its grandfather certificate. The Court of Civil Appeals agreed that Tahoma had met the two factual criteria in Section 53, that it had filed on time and it was serving a pre-existing area as of the effective date of the statute. The Court of Civil Appeals, however, found that solely because the City of Tahoma could not be a public utility for purposes of Section 53, it was not entitled to a grandfather certificate. We think that decision is incorrect. We think that a city can be a public utility for purposes of Article 7 certification. Article 7 is that portion of the Public Utility Regulatory Act that creates the certification mechanism. I might point out that this argument that a city cannot be a public utility originated by the Attorney General's office in its district court brief. It was never raised by any of the parties at the hearing. The hearings examiner never questioned the status of the City of Tahoma as a public utility. The commission in its order never questioned the status of the city as a public utility. And in fact, the Public Utility Commission granted numerous grandfather certificates to cities. In fact, that's reflected in the record in the docket in which this case was heard by the commission. If you look at the statutory scheme set up by the Public Utility Regulatory Act, it is inconceivable that the legislature would have chosen to discriminate against cities in such a fashion. I can understand the initial exclusion of cities under the definition of public utility in the front part of the Act. The term public utility is pervasive throughout the Act. In fact, it's in the title of the Act. There are all sorts of activities by public utilities that the Commission regulates. And the Commission and those who drafted the statute did not want to get involved in those numerous decisions if it only involved a city serving its own customers. But you've got that Article 7 that talks about certification, and there they use a unique term, retail public utility. And retail public utility specifically includes a municipality. We think that the district court and the dissenting opinion by Justice Keith in the Court of Civil Appeals correctly makes the argument that the only way to read the statute is that a retail public utility, which includes the city, is a public utility for purposes of grandfather certification. That's essentially the only statutory approach or interpretation that doesn't just carve out cities and treat them inequitably. The availability of Section 54, the merit certificate section, doesn't really help cities sufficiently if they're not entitled to some sort of grandfather certificate for their pre-existing service. Section 54 is not really designed to deal with pre-existing water service. It's designed to talk about prospective service. The type of criteria that have to be considered under Section 54 are much more geared to somebody who is thinking of going into the water service area. So if you look at Section 54, it doesn't fully provide the relief that the City of Tahoma or any city would need for an area that it has been serving for some time in the past. I want to just point out one little thing that I think is very persuasive to the argument that we're making. Section 49B of the Act talks about those things which are excluded from the definition of public utility. And that section talks about, it excludes a municipality covered by the Railroad Commission's jurisdiction. It lists all of the entities, and it says if those entities are covered or are governed by the Railroad Commission, they're not to be included as public utilities. Now, if a city were not a public utility for any purpose, there would be absolutely no need to specifically point out in Section 49B that a city that's regulated by the Railroad Commission is not a public utility. That would be an absolutely redundant and unnecessary provision. I want to point out that in the handout that the Attorney General's office has given you, citing provisions of the Act, they left out Section 49B. They cite Section 49A, and they don't even show three dots indicating that 49B was deleted. I think 49B, which is quoted in our brief, helps buttress the argument that the only reasonable interpretation of the statute is to read the term public utility as being a type, excuse me, retail public utility as being a type of public utility for these certification purposes.
Thank you, Counsel. I believe we'll hear some argument from respondents before we take a break.
May it please the Court, Mr. Wilson and Mr. Olson will argue for the respondents. Mr. Wilson will open. Please lay the Court would like to set up the visual aid.
May it please the Court, I would like to point out a very obvious typographical error in our reply to the application of the City of Tahoma in our first reply point. State Court of Civil Appeals was correct in holding the city was a public utility for the purposes of Article 7. I believe it's supposed to say was not. I believe that Justice Keith might take exception to our first reply point, so we filed we sent a letter to Mr. Jackson making a correction on this point. As Ms. Giblin explained, this deals with basically an interpretation of Article 7 of the Public Utility Regulatory Act, which has some fairly confusing language in it, to say the least. But before getting to those provisions, I would like to just provide an overview of what section Article 7 does. Article 7 provides for the certification of public utility and provides for two types of certificates. One is Burton's grandmother's certificate.
You haven't been a rock and hard place.
Okay.
First,
under Section 53, we provide for what we call grandfather certificates. Those are for the facilities that were in place on the effective date of the Act, September 1, 1975. What it covers is somewhat disputed, but it's not pertinent to the main point of this case on the public utility question. What it covers is basically the facilities that were actually there, like the 200-foot corridor that's prescribed by the Rules Commission. And in this case, as Ms. Giblin indicated, that type of certificate for this area was denied to the city. The second is under Section 54, which is what we call a merit certificate. And the proof under that is basically that there is a public convenience and necessity for the issuance of that certificate. It covers areas as opposed to facilities. Imagine a square area or a rectangular area, something like that. And in this case, there was one granted district. A particular point of interest, Section 53 provides for the grant of grandfather clause to a public utility. Section 54 does not specify that. Well, the second matter, we come to the provision of Section 53, which is the question herein. What is a public utility under the Public Utility Regulatory Act? Well, the first provisions in the Act are under Article 1, which provides for the general definitions under the Act. Section 3C defines what a public utility is. These are the particular entities. It goes on further down and says what activities these entities must perform in order to be a public utility. But these are particular entities: persons, corporations, river authorities, a cooperative, and then it comes down and specifically includes municipal corporations and water supply or sewer service corporations. Well, then once we get to Article 7, that's where the problem lies, because we have created by Article 7 two creatures in here. One of them is a retail public utility under 49A, and the second one refers back to Section 3C, a public utility. The retail public utility specifies the entity that can be a retail public utility. That is, a person, corporation, a water supply or sewer service corporation, a municipality, a political subdivision or agency, and a cooperative corporation. In the second part, in 49B, which we did inadvertently leave out of the handout, it goes and modifies for the purposes of Article 7 what is the meaning of a public utility. First, it excludes the utility under the jurisdiction of the Railroad Commission. And the second thing it does is it includes a water supply or sewer service corporation. Well, that's interesting to note, because they are saying that they are somehow made a public utility back up here by this exclusion from the Railroad Commission jurisdiction. This Section 49B, for the purposes of Article 7, specifically puts back in the water supply or sewer service corporation.
it does not put back in the municipal corporation. Well, now the next thing is this pertinent point is what are the differences in what a public utility versus a retail public utility can do without a certificate. And these are under the provisions of Section 50 and 51, which are also part of Article 7. Which Section 51A and 50, parenthesis 1, prescribe what a public utility can do. Section 50, parenthesis 1, says a public utility may not serve without a certificate. This basically says that you can't do it. Then it comes back in 51A and says, accepts out the existing facilities as of September 1, 1975. And certain modifications of that you can expand as long as you don't expand in somebody else's territory. In this case, that public utility is under Section 53. The public utility can't get a certificate. No doubt about it under Section 53, the city is not one. Now, the retail public utility, the provision for it is Section 50, parenthesis 2, which provides both things specifically. What it says is you cannot expand in somebody else's territory without a certificate of convenience and necessity. So it says on the public utility part, the provisions for that, it first says, well, you can't serve, but then we're going to accept out existing facilities. And for retail public utilities, it says you cannot expand out without getting another certificate. So in other words, these are the same thing, same two statements for the two different entities. And obviously, there would not have been made these two statements had not there been a difference in these two. The next thing to point out, is what can the commission do as the various as to the two types of utilities. First is to a public utility, or to a retail public utility. Section 56 says that contracts between the commission needs to approve contracts between retail public utilities, basically. While it's a public utility.
Council, are you through with your exhibits?
All right.
I want to suggest you come back over here because I don't think the microphone will record you from over there.
As I was saying, the Article 7 makes different distinctions as to what provisions of the Act apply to a public utility versus a retail public utility. A retail public utility in Section 56, they can regulate the contracts between retail public utilities. Public utility, various sections apply. Section 55, the right to continue service when the city moves outside of the city limits, or when it expands the city limits. Section 60, where the commission can order the public utility to extend its lines to a certain customer. They may order improvements. May order a public utility to make certain improvements under Section 61, and they may order a public utility to make interconnections under Section 61. So, in other words, there are definite distinct differences in what the commission may do with these two entities. Well, and if I might go back over here, what Tahoma has said now is that, well, because we're a retail public utility, by definition of that word, since we're defined as that in Article 7, we must be a public utility, since by a logical, just our knowledge of English language, we know that one of these is a subdivision of the other. And they said, well, why don't you just make us a public utility for the purposes of Article 7, or maybe just for the purposes of Section 53? Well, let's see what kind of construction we have to do to achieve that result. First, we have to go back to the Article 1, Section 3C4, and we have to amend the municipal corporation and put a caveat on it saying except for Section 53, you're excluded from the utility status, or else you go back, you go to Article 7 here, and include the municipal corporation along with Section, along with water supply or sewer service corporation. The second thing you do to clean up matters, as we said, there is a redundancy in these provisions as to what you can and cannot do. If the city is in fact a retail public, a public utility along with a retail public utility, there are absolutely no, there's no reason to have Section 50 parentheses 2. That's a complete redundancy. So we'll just wipe out that in the instruction of that. The third thing we'll have to do is go through Article 7, where they haven't been, where they're still excluded from being a public utility, and go through each of the 18 other places they name. They refer to a public utility and say, well, does that apply to the city in this instance? And I would believe if the city were pressed for that matter, they would not want those provisions, those other provisions, because they apply to them because they are in fact liabilities under Article 7. Now, the thing we do, now what do we do to simplify this? Well, we go back to the definition of a retail public utility under Article 7, Section 49, which is the first section on your sheet. And it says, basically, retail public utilities are all these people who now are hereafter operating, maintaining, or controlling in Texas facilities for providing retail utility service. You look at that provision and nowhere in it does it say public. It does not say other than the actual name of this entity. It says retail utility service. Well, maybe this wasn't supposed to be in here. Maybe this was just a word that is inconsistent with the rest of the provision. And we'll just cross this out or construct it out saying, well, maybe we didn't really mean that in conjunction with looking back here to Article 1. When you do that, everything falls right into place. The city is still not a municipal, it's still not a public utility, but the city can be a retail utility because they sell retail and they are a utility, although there is some confusion under the definitions as to what the actual term utility is. And we haven't changed the meaning of this. So in other words, what I'm saying is that this word was put in here by mistake. Somebody came along and we said, well, we're going to prescribe what the brown dog over here. And then we say, well, we're going to say, you're a big brown dog. But then at some point, somebody realizes, well, you're not a brown dog, but you're a big dog. So we've got to look at these as symbols. This symbol was just inconsistent with this. These provisions are not inconsistent with these when you straighten out the symbol applied to the various pieces. Now, Justice Keith, in his dissenting opinion, attacked the position of the commission, the holding of the majority, saying, well, you're depriving the right of the city to, in essence, defend their territory, to keep their territory. Well, the answer to that is the Section 53 does not give them the right to defend their territory. All the Section 53 says you can go in and get a certificate of public convenience and necessity reflecting your facilities as of September 1, 1975. The provision which protects the city-owned utility, the retail public utility, from invasion are Section 50, parenthesis 2, which says you cannot invade another retail public utility without first getting a certificate. That is wherein they're protected, and they are protected under the Act. Now, as far as...
Russell, would you mind telling me what the facts of the case are? I think this is very highly technical and very enjoyable.
Yes.
All right. tell me about whose pipes are going where and who doesn't want them.
The factual situation basically is, back about 25 years ago, the Howard County Water Control and Improvement District was formed, and they bought certain mains coming from the city of Big Spring to the city of Coahoma to bring water to that city. Subsequent to that, the city began providing service. They performed basically the billing and maintenance functions for certain residents outside the city of Coahoma, which is the area, the particular area we are dealing with.
When you say they, you mean the district or the city?
The city performed, basically we have a system where there is some dispute as to what the exact facts are, but we contend that there was a system wherein the district owned the system, owned the mains, and owned some of the distribution lines. Most part of the customers owned the distribution lines. And the city performed the billing and maintenance functions on that system. Now the question was factually before the commission outside this public utility question was, who was the actual utility providing the service? What the commission found was that in fact the city of Coahoma was the agent of the water district, and therefore the utility involved, actual utility involved, actual entity was the Howard County Water Control and Improvement District, that the city was only the agent, and that you do not certify an agent of a public utility for a certificate of public convenience and necessity. The district court essentially said that finding was not supported by substantial evidence. We have brought that before this court as well as numerous other points. There was also, for the area involved, there was a Section 54 certificate granted to the water district. The district court set aside that as not being supported by substantial evidence and not being supported by proper fact findings. We have brought up both certificates. In other words, we have a denial of one type of certificate and a grant of another type of certificate. The district court set aside both of those. Most of the citations of the evidence are in the various replies and the various applications. One further thing, we would like to submit to the court the point on the Section 54 certificate granted to the water district. The Beaumont court more or less summarily said these are not supported by substantial evidence. We would like to submit those to the court. The last thing is on the Section 53 certificate granted to the the Section 53 certificate that was denied to the city. The Beaumont court said in regard to that certificate, we're going to remand it. We want you to consider it under Section 54. Well, we have attacked that, and we pointed it out in our motion for rehearing and in our brief, that that should not be remanded under Section 54 because simply the city has never wanted a Section 54 certificate. They've never applied for one. They've never put on the case. They have never complained about it in any of the courts. We feel that in that case, if the court does uphold the denial of the city, as the Beaumont court did, there is the proper remedy in that situation is to uphold the commission as to that order. Thank you.
Council, before we proceed further, before we take a brief recess.
It pleases the court, my name is Lyndon Olson, and I am the attorney for Howard County Water Control Improvement District Number 1, and have been working with the Attorney General's office on this case since it was appealed from the ruling of the Public Utility Commission. I handled the matter for the Water District before the Public Utility Commission. I would point out that We had two rather lengthy hearings. The transcript consisted of some 600 or 800 pages at the two hearings, plus a number of exhibits, all of which I'm sure are in the possession of the court. So it was a full-blown hearing, and it is a involved fact situation, but it's not complicated, but I think it is necessary for the court to understand, to appreciate the facts in this case. I'd like very briefly, in the 10 minutes that I have, to point out briefly what the facts are and how I think that they're relevant. It's the position of Howard County that the city of Tahoma is not entitled to a Section 53 permit. One, for the reason that it's not a public utility, as has been discussed by Scott Wilson. And for the other reason, that is found by the Public Utility Commission after this extensive hearing, Tahoma, City of Tahoma, was not a public utility actually providing service to any geographic area at the effective date of the Public Utility Regulatory Act was passed in 1975.
Council, get us further out of this vacuum that I'm in.
Yes, sir.
Does this deal only with water utilities?
It only involves water, yes, sir. Sewer is relevant, and I'll try to point that out.
How about electricity?
Sir?
Electricity.
No,
a lot of cities
water.
Sell electricity
just
outside
water.
The city limits. Are we talking about that?
No, nothing except water.
Okay.
In 1955, the city of Tahoma is located in the eastern boundary of Howard County. Prior to 1955, Tahoma had wells. And in 55, the wells ran out, and so they had to have another source of water. So at that time, a water control improvement district was organized, the reason being that Tahoma apparently wasn't able to float the bonds themselves. So a water control improvement district was organized, and the first issue of bonds was $155,000 in bonds that were issued in 1955. Now, these bonds were issued by the water district, and they authorized the laying of a water line from Big Spring to Tahoma. Now, it's important to point out to the court that it's 11 miles from Big Spring to the city limits of Tahoma.
How has the water district been paying for it?
They've been paying off these bonds based upon a contract between the water district and the city of Tahoma. Under the terms of this contract, the city of Tahoma buys treated water from the Water Control Improvement District and pays to the Water District the same price that the Water District pays to the City of Big Spring. Additionally, the City of Tahoma pays a sufficient amount of money each month to retire these bonds and further has contracted in this contractual agreement, which was dated in March of 1955, that as additional consideration for the seller making water available to buyers, the Water District made it available to Tahoma. Under the terms hereof, Tahoma agrees to pay for and accomplish the operation and maintenance of the Water District's facilities.
Does the water come from Martin County?
It comes from Big Spring. And they buy treated water from the city of Big Spring.
Well, where does Big Spring get its water?
Big Spring gets it from some source that I'm not familiar with.
From Martin County.
It may be, yes.
Because I helped organize that.
Yes. Well, they get it, and they buy this treated water from Big Spring, and then they sell it to the water district.
So you now, both retail.
Well, they sell it, of course, they sell it for one price to Big Spring. The water district up to this time has had only one customer, and that was the city of Tahoma. Now, they built this 6-inch line with this $155,000 issue and ran 11 miles from Big Spring, where they got treated water, to the city of Tahoma. Out of this $155,000 issue, they also built about 7,500 feet of a 2-inch line and about 2,500 feet of 4-inch line in the Sand Springs area, which is the unincorporated area between Big Spring and Tahoma, this 11 miles. During this period of time, there were a few residents in the Sand Springs area. And so the city of Tahoma, if these people wanted water, would go out and tap onto these lines, and whoever wanted water would pay all of the cost of tapping onto the main line.
and then Tahoma was built. Well, this went along and no problems existed because there wasn't much development in the Sand Springs area until in the 60s, Interstate 20 was built and runs right down the middle of this water district, 11 miles from Big Spring to Tahoma. And when Interstate 20 was built, development started taking place between Tahoma and Big Spring. And so in 1962, they needed more water in Tahoma. And so another bond issue was passed. This was for $230,000. And a 12-inch line was constructed by the Howard County Water Control Improvement District running from Big Spring to Tahoma. And in addition to that, a 250,000-gallon storage tank was built right out of the city of Tahoma. Now, this is a situation that existed, and all of the water district's water was sold to Tahoma. So anytime anybody wanted water, they went to Tahoma, and Tahoma went out, and the individual that wanted the water paid all of the expenses, and they just tapped on to the water district's main, either a 12-inch main or a 6-inch main, and started buying this treated water. It never went to Tahoma. It came right out of the water district's line through their meter, and they paid Tahoma.
This went on. Were they obligated to discharge those bonds? Two bond issues under the contract?
All of the Tahoma was obligated to retire the bonds.
It still is, even though...
Yes, but the second issue, the $230,000 issue in 1962, was altogether tax bonds. The first issue was tax and revenue bonds. The second issue was tax bonds altogether. So the whole district, which incidentally is much larger outside of Tahoma than it is in Tahoma. This went on until 1970.
Excuse me, who issued the bonds, the district or the city?
The district, the city has never issued any bonds. This went on until about 1975. And in 75, there'd been a good little bit of development, and Tahoma was still tapping into these lines. And the water district then found out that they were faced with a dangerous situation. One, the engineers had told them, and the testimony brings all this out, that it was dangerous and unsanitary to be tapping into these 12-inch lines for 1 meter going to an individual's house. Also, the 250,000-gallon tank was at Tahoma, and if there was a break doing it anywhere in this 11 miles, the Sand Springs area, or the unincorporated area, was out of water because the valves were such that it couldn't go back this way, and so they were out of water until it was repaired. Tahoma still had water. So, as a result, in the early 70s, Tahoma decided they weren't going to pay the water district. They were charging too much. The water district sued them and recovered a $30,000 judgment against the city of Tahoma. And then in 1975, the water district wrote a letter to the city saying, we're going to take over these duties that y'all have been providing for us and start selling water ourselves. The city of Tahoma filed a lawsuit against the water district, and it was pending at the time these proceedings began. Now, it's a contention of the water district now, and was before the PUC, that actually the city of Tahoma was not a public utility, actually providing service to any geographic area outside the city of Tahoma. It took the position that actually the only thing they were doing was tapping into this line. The water never went to Tahoma and came back. The water was costing $6.50 and for 10,000 gallons, they were selling it to this individual outside the city of Tahoma for about $15. They were making about $10, I think it was, for every one if he used 10,000 gallons through this whole area. And there were 450 customers outside the city of Tahoma, and 430 inside the city of Tahoma. So it was a position of the water district before the Public Utility Commission, and the Public Utility Commission so found that Tahoma was entitled to a Section 53 permit inside the city of Tahoma. They were not entitled to a permit in the area of the water district outside the city of Tahoma. In the meantime, because of this development...
Counsel, do you have some more you want to say to us?
Well, my time's up.
Well, I'm about to ask you to take some of it.
Well,
I'm beginning to understand the case. It's very helpful.
Yes, sir. Well, I appreciate it.
Give another 5 minutes and you have just 5 minutes. All right. Thank you.
Also, during this period of time, with the development that was taking place as a result of the construction of Interstate 25, Interstate 20, the water district determined that it was necessary for them to put in a sewer system. Up to that time, they'd only had septic tanks, and it was getting to be carbon refineries out there and the carbon black, and there's a lot of development up and down there, trailer homes in this park line. So the city hired an engineer, the water district hired an engineer to do engineering studies as far as putting in a sewer system. And the engineer said that the water district needed to take over the retail selling of water to individual customers throughout the district in order to issue sewer bonds. And this was another reason that this action was taken by the Howard County Water Control Improvement District. The city has taken the position that that they were actually the only ones that were providing water service outside the city of Tahoma and in the water district, even though the undisputed evidence shows that all of the water that was being sold was sold either directly off of the 6-inch main or directly off of the 12-inch main of the Water Control and Improvement District, or off of the 4-inch line or the 2-inch line that the district had installed back in 1955. Or in all of the other connections, the city never paid for anything. Any of the other extensions that were made, they tapped directly on the mains where they could. If they couldn't tap directly on the main, the individual property owner had to pay the total cost of laying the line, purchasing a meter, and so forth. And the city was charging on a, the evidence shows that on a 3/4-inch tap inside the city, Ms. Gibbons said there was no difference in the treatment. Well, I submit to the court that this is not reflected by the testimony. The evidence shows that inside the city of Tahoma was charging $25 to make a 3/4-inch tap. And they would run 250 feet of line free of charge. Outside the city, in the water district, they were charging $60 for a 3/4-inch tap, and they wouldn't run 1 inch of water line. It all had to be run by the individual users. The engineer who testified on behalf of the water district before the PUC testified that that there were too many connections on these lines to comply with the Department of Public Health, I believe it was, one of the rules and regulations that govern the use of water and the sale of water, that you couldn't have on more than so many taps in any certain length, and that there were too many. This 12-inch line is an asbestos line. And the engineer said that any more taps would dangerously affect the overall area. Additionally, there are a lot of shallow wells. No precautions were being taken to see that the people that were using the shallow wells were also getting the water so that they would turn the polluted water back into the main. And these are some of the reasons that the water district took this action. These were some of the reasons that the Public Utility Commission, after these extensive hearings, held that one, Tahoma, was not a public utility actually providing service to any geographical area as set forth in Section 53 of the Act, and also that Howard County Water Control Improvement District Number 1 could better serve this area and provide the needs of the people outside the city of Tahoma, but within the water district. That very briefly, Your Honor, are the facts, and I'd be glad to answer any specific questions.
This situation, would it be possible for a water district to actually go in and get the permit to serve inside a city limit? Does the commission have that authority? I assume most of the cities already have their permits.
Most of them do.
If one has not gotten one, could he do it?
They might, I really don't know, Your Honor. I would assume that they might be able to, but of course no effort has been made and none would be made for the water district to move inside the city, because the city owns those mains inside the city limits of the city of Tahoma. As far as I know, are providing good service inside the city of Tahoma. And the water district is only interested in adequately serving the area outside the city of Tahoma, and that was the request that they made.
Counsel, would it be, would the city of Tahoma have any more obligations to pay additional money other than the first $165,000 that was extended through the bond? The first issue of bond was $165,000.
Yes.
Do they incur any time after that any additional obligations of any nature, as bonds or other than for the maintenance of the line?
No, sir, other than the same obligation that was assumed by all of the residents and all of the taxpayers of the whole district. The second issue, the 1962 issue, which was $230,000, was a tax bond issue. And of course, the tax burden was spread throughout the district, Tahoma being a part of the district. Thank you, gentlemen.
A rebuttal argument from petitioner?
May it please the court. I have to take some exception to some of the facts that were recited just recently. After hearing that recitation of the facts, you probably wonder why the district court and the Court of Civil Appeals found that it was uncontroverted that the city of Tahoma was actually providing service. I want to clarify one basic point that will help put everything in perspective. The water that is being supplied by the district is wholesale water from Big Spring to the city of Tahoma. The only service of retail operations in that area has always been conducted by the city of Tahoma. Now, if anybody was the agent of the other, it would have been that the district was the agent of Tahoma. In 1955, the district was created as a financing vehicle to provide the mechanism, just as you do with industrial revenue bonds, all sorts of bonding types of operations. The district was created to provide the bond issue. The city of Tahoma has always operated the system. At the hearing, the uncontroverted testimony, even by the representatives of the district, was that the water service was being provided by the city of Tahoma. They never really attempted until after the hearing to develop this argument of, oh no, in fact, we were the ones that were providing it. You even look at the contract provision that's cited by the district and the Attorney General's office in its brief, and it talks about the operation of the buyer's water distribution system, the buyer being Tahoma. See, what's talked about in the certification is certification of retail utilities, not wholesale. So if you're buying your water wholesale from an entity, that is not the operator of the water distribution system.
Does it appear in the record whether Big Spring is also a retailer and the district is a retailer, or does that make any difference?
It appears in the record that the district is not a retailer. They acknowledge that they were not a retailer. As to whether Big Spring, in addition to wholesaling water, provides retail service within its city limits is not in the record.
Does the district have its own well?
The district, sir?
Yeah.
There's no evidence in the record that it does.
It doesn't have its own well. It's buying it from somebody.
That's right.
So it's a retailer?
Well, no, sir. It's essentially a middleman wholesaler is what it is. They're buying and they are selling. They are selling to the city of Tahoma, and the transmission name, the main transmission name from Big Spring to Tahoma, were what was paid for with the original bond issue. The distribution lines were not paid for or bought by the district. Those were laid by the city of Tahoma's employees. And as is a customary practice, even here in the city of Austin, when you want to have a line run out to your house, you pay for that extension. But that doesn't make it your line, or that doesn't make you the operator of the system. It's the city of Austin or whatever city happens to be supplying the distribution of the water. Several other things that I think are important to clarify in this record. There was absolutely no testimony, there was testimony that there were some problems with perhaps overtapping or overcapacity. But the district never put on any evidence to show that if a certificate were awarded to it under this merit certificate section, that they could improve conditions. Now, the Public Utility Regulatory Act says that in order to be entitled to a certificate, you've got to show that you can bring about some improvement of service or some lowering of cost. It's not enough to simply go to hearing and fling rocks at somebody else's operation. You have to show that you can improve the system. and there was absolutely no evidence to that effect. In fact, the district testified that they didn't have any idea how much it would cost them if they got into the retail business operation. In our brief, we set out portions from the transcript where the district president is in fact quoted as saying, "We recognize that Tahoma has been providing this service, and what we're proposing would change the entire picture of this. We now want to get into the water service operation." I think Mr. Olson correctly indicated that there's growth out in that area, and so I think there's an incentive for people to want to get into the water game. But under the Act, you're not entitled to do that unless you show that you can improve the situation in some way. I want to point out that the City of Tahoma system has been approved by the Texas Department of Health, so that any allusions to any kind of health problems are simply not reflected by the record. Repairs to the system are paid solely out of City of Tahoma tax money. That's done by City of Tahoma crews. They go out there, they maintain and repair the system, and that's done solely with taxpayer money. I also want to point out, as I stated in my original presentation, that there are some connections even outside the district that are being served by the City of Tahoma's service operations. These are on the east side of the City of Tahoma. So that if the district were to receive certification for this area, it would probably leave these connections just without any kind of service, because the district would find it very difficult to run a line all the way around the City of Tahoma to serve these people who are on the other side of the city. But I think the main thing to keep in mind in this whole thing is that both the district court and the Court of Civil Appeals found that it was uncontested that the City of Tahoma was providing the retail utility service. I think if you look at the record, that's very plain. If you look at the record, you'll also see that the criteria that are set out in Section 54, the merit certificate section, which is the one under which the district obtained its certificate, are simply not met. The Court of Civil Appeals found that the grant of the Section 54 certificate was not supported by substantial evidence. I submit that it's not supported by any evidence on some of the criteria. You've got about six criteria set out there. And on the key issues under a Section 54 certificate, which is this question of probable improvement of service or lowering of cost, the district presented absolutely no evidence that it could do this. So I submit to you in closing that it's one thing to be able to go to Siri and say, oh, this system which has been operating since 1955 is not really adequate, it's overtaxed, it should be done differently, and it's quite another to be able to show that you're entitled to it. So finally, it's our position that the City of Tahoma has met the two factual criteria for a grandfather certificate. We applied for our application. We filed our application by March 1st, 1976, and we were actually providing retail water service to the area in question on September 1st, 1975. Those are the two criteria of Section 53. Furthermore, we feel that we do qualify as a public utility because we're clearly a retail public utility, and that is a type of public utility. Therefore, we respectfully ask that you rule that as a matter of law, we are entitled to our grandfather.
One question is given. On the functions that were being performed by the water district, as I understand you, Mr. Olson, the district was formed as a financing vehicle, well, that was your description of it, in order to get water from Big Spring over to Tahoma. What did the district board of directors do, or what service, if any, did they perform if the city maintained the lines and made all the taps? What had the district been doing during this period of time?
Absolutely nothing. The record very clearly reflects they were an absolutely dormant board. It wasn't until they decided to get into the water business that they put together this application. But their function was that they performed no function whatsoever after they served as a financing group.
Well, they had a contractual responsibility, though, with the, or the city had a responsibility by contract to the board, though, did not.
To pay off the bond, sir.
And to maintain?
Say the board?
And to maintain? Mine?
Sir, I don't read that contract that way. I don't think they had a contractual arrangement that went into the details of the operation of the system. The contractual arrangement dealt with how the bonds were going to be paid off, who was going to pay for those bonds. But the contract simply refers to the fact that Tahoma is going to operate the system.
Does the district assess a tax now to pay the second bond?
Sir, that's not in the record, and I simply don't know. I know that the second bond issue does include a tax, because that's been brought up in oral arguments, but it wasn't in the record.
Well, how are they being paid now, then? Is that the record?
I believe they're being paid for by taxes and revenue. So I'm not positive if that point is in the record or whether it's just been brought up so often in oral arguments. But that's why I know it. Thank you.
The case is submitted on this. Case is submitted on written brief and oral argument for both parties. This concludes the oral submissions for today, and the marshal is adjourned to court.